Okay, and just before the message, just a reminder, which I'll put on the record for those who listen to these messages later in the day, which is there is no Bible study next Sabbath, no Bible study next Sabbath. The next Bible study will be after the Feast of Tabernacles is all over. Okay, well, I think we've had three weeks looking at the topic of prophecy and focusing largely on the books of Daniel and Revelation. Obviously, way back in the early part of the year, we spoke for, 12, 13, 14 weeks in much more detail. This is more of a bit of a resume because of the things happening out there in the world. Now, last week, we spent most of last week looking at Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, you may recollect, hopefully. In Revelation 13, there are two beasts identified. The first beast has seven heads and 10 horns, appears to be a composite of the four beasts of Daniel 7. So you can see there references to a lion, a bear, a leopard, and 10 horns. My speculation, my suggestion, is that that appears to be the end time Islamic empire comprising of 10 individual Islamic nations. And it tells us in Revelation 13 they make war with the saints for 42 months. There is a traditional view that probably most of us grew up with, which is actually this first beast of Revelation 13 is the sort of Holy Roman Empire, and that the 42 months represent actually 1260 years in prophecy from 554 AD to the fall of Napoleon in 1814. I don't think that's right, but that's probably what most of us have believed. Then in Revelation 13 is a second beast who looks like a lamb, has two horns, and this particular beast encourages worship of the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And in that reference to the second beast, we've got mention of the mark of the beast. And we covered last week that probably most of us would have perceived that second beast to be perhaps the Vatican, the papacy, Catholic Church, using the beast empire to enforce Sunday worship. Okay, don't think so. The alternative might be, as a suggestion, that this second beast is the Islamic Antichrist, the end-time Islamic caliph, who is the supreme authority over 1.7 billion Muslims and over their nations, who holds both spiritual and civil authority. And that was Revelation 13, so that's a bit of a quick run-through. Then we got to Revelation 17 last week, talking of the great harlot who rides a scarlet beast. And in chapter 18, we see the destruction, the judgment of that great harlot. So Revelation 17 and 18 go together. There are no chapter breaks in the original scriptures. And we said last week, well, chapter 17 does give us some identifiers. It tells us the great harlot is to be found in the wilderness or in the desert place, Eremos in Greek. It says that this great harlot has international influence because she's over peoples, multitudes, nations, and different tongues. She's also said to be a great city. And I've suggested that Mecca could well be the solution to this query, because Mecca is, of course, the holy city of Islam, its most holy city. It's the birthplace of Islam. Every day, up to 1.7 billion Muslims are praying towards Mecca. And if you think about it, you know, Mecca and the Saudi Arabian royal family that live there have got worldwide influence, and I think actually a fair amount of worldwide corruption by virtue of their oil wealth. They have numerous trading agreements for oil with presidents, prime ministers, national leaders, company CEOs, who all get rich by trading with Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia gets rich, and Saudi Arabia is quite well known to be a supporter, a sponsor of terrorism. And in a sense, the nations are committing both spiritual and economic fornication or whoredom with this woman. It refers often to the wine of her fornication. That's quite likely to be the oil. Then chapter 18, we covered very briefly, I admit, the destruction of this this harlot, this city, this woman. It says she's utterly burned with fire. All her plagues, it says, come in one day, which I take to be 24 hours. And the utterly burned with fire reference may include, you know, nuclear weaponry being used. And it turns out, as we read those chapters, that the main enemy who turns on her is actually the other Islamic nations. The ten horns turn against her. And not a great surprise there, because I think many of them hate her or are jealous of her. So that's a suggestion I put forward as to who the great harlot is and what happens to her. The other alternative traditional view is that it's talking of a Rome, Western Europe, with 10 European nations combining together and probably led by Germany. I don't see it, but it's a popular view. So my suggestion has been, and it is only a suggestion, that you and I should be carefully watching the nations of the Middle East, watching Islam. I've said watch particularly Turkey and Iran. That's the he-goat and ram of Daniel chapter 8. Watch President Erdogan of Turkey. Watch for the possible restoration of Islamic supremacy in Turkey. Watch the possible resurrection of the old Ottoman Empire. The beast whose deadly wound might yet be healed. Watch Iran, watch its IRGC, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which I think is one of the two horns of the ram, and watch all the jostling for power and the hostility. Now, historically, we should bear in mind that the Islamic empires, the former Islamic caliphates, have ruled huge, huge areas of the world. All across North Africa, through the Middle East, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, right up into Turkey, through Iraq, through Iran, across to Pakistan, into Afghanistan, the southern states of Russia, at times right across Western Europe, up to Spain for centuries, and into France. You know, you're not, we might in the West just think of, you know, the Arab countries, Islamic countries historically, as a bunch of amateurs running around on camels. Uh-huh. No. This was a powerful ruling empire, major empire, covering, you know, huge amounts of the known world, and ruled from about, you know, for over 1,400 years, from about 600-ish right through to 1922. And they pulverized and they crushed and they steamrollered wherever they went. And unlike historically most empires, they just tended to want a bit more territory, a bit more money, a bit more treasures. That's what motivated lots of countries in their warfare. The Islamic Empire was driven by religion. They conquered in the name of Allah. Quite different from those who came before them. And today, just to summarize this point, there are very powerful armies to be found across the Middle East and the Islamic countries. They've got access to extremely modern military technology, most of it thanks to Russia and the US of A. These things occasionally come back to bite you in the bum, as they say. Okay, well, that's the previous 3 weeks, summarized in 5 minutes. Today, we're going to move on and study, or at least review, one key passage that is applicable to today. And that's the passage that covers the King of the North fighting the King of the South, which we find in Daniel chapter 11. You may as well turn towards that. So who is the King of the North? Well, traditionally, we're going to say, well, that's sort of the Holy Roman Empire of Western Europe, led probably by Germany. And if you read any of the booklets, articles, listen to any messages from sort of the old Worldwide Church of God, from today's United Church of God, from the Living Church of God, from the Restored Church of God, etc., etc., pretty much the mainstream ones anyway, they'll tell you that is the case. The King of the North, that's the Holy Roman Empire, or probably some German. Is that the case? Well, you probably suspect I'm going to say no, having spent the last several weeks and 3 months during the year saying that Europe just doesn't fit the scriptures. What about the King of the South? Well, it's usually a little bit sort of vague in most of the stuff I've come across, but it sort of points towards, they will tell you, maybe Egypt, could be Ethiopia, some Arab-type countries of some sort, maybe with some oil. So it gets a bit sort of vague and blurred, I've got to say, other than if you go to the to Gerald Flurry, and he's very plain. So the PCG, the Philadelphia Church of God, is absolutely blunt and clear. The King of the South is Iran. And they've got a whole booklet on that. All right? King of the South, Iran. No question. I think that's rubbish, I've got to say, because Iran happens to be due east of Jerusalem and the Holy Land. And if you take the capital of Iran, which is Tehran, is actually northeast of Jerusalem. How could that be King of the South when it's northeast of everywhere that matters? Anyway, we'll get to that a bit later. What is clear is that at the end time, the King of the North and the King of the South play a major part at the very, very end of the end time. So it'd be good for us to have a view as to who these two characters are and what we should be expecting, what we should be looking for. We're supposed to watch the signs of the times. Well, there's two big players here. They've got a big part to play at the very end. Who are they and what are they doing? Okay, let's turn to Daniel 11 and look at verses 40 to 41, just to have a sort of taste before we look at more detail. Daniel 11:40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, many ships. He shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also, the king of the north, enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Now, we're coming back to that later, but you can see here, it's the time of the end, right? So, Marky, when is the time of the end? You know, we're going to say, well, it's our time today. But maybe it meant just later in Daniel's life, do we think? Could it have meant just 100 years after the Persian Empire had folded up? Some people will tell you, at the time of the end, that's when Jesus was around. Some will say, at the time of the end, that's when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. When is the time of the end? Can we tell for sure? Well, we can, and it's roughly today, you know, give or take a few years. And here's the king of the south attacking the king of the north, and all manner of things then happen. So, you know, who are they? Well, in some ways, I've often listened to messages where somebody says, blah, 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 open the Bible to Daniel 11, let's read verses 40 and 41, all the rest of it. That's not really a terribly good way to approach a responsible evaluation of the scriptures, because it's in the middle of the story. It doesn't start at verse 40 of Daniel 11, but it doesn't even start at Daniel 11. You know, what's not always clear is that actually, as we'll see ourselves in a moment, there's an entire vision here that spreads from Daniel 10 through 11 all the way through 12 to the end of the chapter. There's one continuous story, Daniel 11 and 12 and 13. Now, I think we're all aware that, you know, chapter breaks didn't come in the original Bibles, right? I think we're all glad we have them. And verses numbered as well, so you can find things, otherwise we'll be all over the shop looking for bits and pieces. But chapter breaks sometimes just interrupt the flow. And they make you think sometimes, oh, Daniel 12, something new's happening here. No, it's not. Daniel 12 is the unbroken continuation of Daniel 11, which is the unbroken continuation of Daniel 10. The guy who, I guess, helpfully split the Bible into chapters was an Englishman, Stephen Langton, way back in the 1200s AD, so 800-odd years ago. It's a useful thing he's done, but just have to be careful, all of us, that we don't allow a chapter break to make us think we finished one topic
and on to the next.
And we're on to another topic. The chapter breaks sometimes are perhaps where there is a natural break, but very often it's right in the middle. And if you think, you know, if you do a chapter a day sort of scenario, you know, I'm reading my Bible a chapter a day, fair enough. And so on one day you finish chapter 11, you go to bed, you wake up, you have a busy day, and then later you pick up chapter 12, you may not be conscious that actually it's still the same material. So let's go back to Daniel chapter 10 and start where it begins. Let's read Daniel 10 verses 1 through 14. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, today we'd call this Iran, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. So the Jews would have known him, by, I guess, by his Hebrew name, Daniel, but to the Persians, and before that the Babylonians, he'd be known to them as, you know, Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, in other words, a long way off. And he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. In those days I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled, 21 days. And on the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with gold of Uphaz, His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like torches of fire, his arms and feet like burnished bronze in color, the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. This is obviously a very powerful and awesome-looking angel. I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision. Only a great terror fell upon them, so that they fled to hide themselves. So something spooked them, and off they ran. Therefore I was left alone when I saw this great vision, and no strength remained in me, for my vigour was turned to frailty in me. I retained no strength. It looks like he fell on his face. Verse 9, yet I heard the sound of his words, and while I heard the sound of his words, I was in a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground. So I guess he just swooned and collapsed over. Then suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, this angel, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, which incidentally must be quite encouraging. If someone comes from God and says, hey, you're greatly beloved. Now, actually, we should all know we are. We're all, you know, beloved by God, but this was perhaps less common in those days. You know, Daniel, God loves you. You're a great guy in his sight. O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you. Stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling, still shaking. He said to me, don't fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I've come because of your words. Now remember, Daniel had been fasting for 21 days. And what the angel says is, when you began your fast 21 days ago, God sent me to give you understanding. And so we would think, if we weren't already familiar with the passage, well, I guess the angel arrives 5 minutes later. Yeah, it might be a few billion miles from God's throne to get to where Daniel is. So, you know, a few minutes, you know, high speed angelic, and you're there. But of course, it didn't happen that way. He says, verse 13, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. How could that happen? He was the prince. Well, because it turns out to be a powerful spirit being. The prince of the kingdom of Persia held me back. prevented my arrival for 21 days. I was sent on day one. I've been unable to get to you, Daniel, for 3 weeks, even though I'm a powerful, mighty, angelic messenger. Behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, so, you know, the prince withheld me, but another prince turned up to help me. Michael, the prince, came to help me, for I'd been left alone there with the kings of Persia, I guess other spirit beings over Persia. And, of course, I'm going to hazard a guess, they're still there today. Spirit beings don't die, do they? So if the prince, principality, power over Persia in Daniel's day, there's a pretty good chance that those spirit principalities and powers are still there today. And I guess they're still doing things today, and that might explain some of the spiritual darkness and violence that you get in some of these countries, because these beings are still around. Anyway, Gabriel couldn't get past. Thankfully, Michael, the archangel, turned up, you know, kicked a few people around, and eventually Gabriel could make it. So, verse 14, "Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people," that's the Jews essentially, "in the latter days." For the vision refers to many days yet to come. So a great message coming, you know, from God to Daniel. And notice when it relates to, when does it relate to? The latter days, right? Many days yet to come. Does that mean 70 AD? Well, some people say, yes, it does. Some say even earlier. I'm going to say that because chapters 10 and 11 and 12 are one completely continuous, integrated vision, we'll see later, it's the end time. And in fact, it's the end of the end time. So I've said earlier, well, let's start at 11:2 then. So let's jump forward to the next chapter. Remember, we're jumping chapters, but same. You know, the conversation is still ongoing. The angel hasn't gone back to heaven for 5 years. And this is another part. This is all just the same story, same conversation. 11, chapter 2. "And now I will tell you the truth," says this angel. "Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece," or Javan. So, the angel begins here his explanation and gives this great vision. And notice it runs all the way through to the end of chapter 12. I have to keep emphasizing that because it's a key. Now, this is where we start reading in this chapter. Most commentators say that verses 2, this one just here, all the way through to verse 32 are all history. Now, we're going to read verse 32 in a while. But this is standard. This is the default view. This is what you get in the worldwide literature and United literature. Verses 2 to 32 are all history. It's all past. Long ago. Some people say actually up to and including verse 35 is all history. And then it sort of gradually shifts to the future. And if that's the case, of course, then you could argue that most of it's not really of particular relevance to us, is it? If verses 2 to 32 or 35 are all history, okay, maybe if you're a studious person, you might like to dig around there. I get the impression most of us aren't particularly studious. maybe of some relevance, but not a lot, because most of us are interested in what's going to happen next, not what happened, 1,500, 2,500 years ago. And you could argue, yeah, we're starting in verse 2 and it's going to go through all the centuries, bit by bit, all the way up to the end time and give us a big picture. That's possibly the case. I would question, actually, whether this is more about the future than the past. I've not come across anybody saying that, but I'm just asking that question. Is really, I just told us a moment ago with the angel that this is for the far distant future. So I'm a bit uneasy that we take this as history, but certainly, a lot of it, I guess, is historical. Nobody's teaching otherwise. But despite the commentators' views that it's all history up to verses 32 or 35, I think it's not. I think it's pretty clear, personally, that the future begins no later than verse 21. Right? I think at verse 21, for sure, we've moved into future prophecy territory. And what the angel is giving us from verse 21 onwards, he's actually giving us a very clear description of the end time Antichrist. There should be enough information from verse 21 onwards for us to have a better chance of recognizing this individual when he appears on this scene, and we can therefore watch better. So the angel is giving us information that we can use. Now, I've said already that Daniel 11, I'm supposed to be fair, Daniel 10 through 12, but essentially the main part of 11 is all about the king of the north and the king of the south. So ever hear about blah, 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 king of the north shall do this, blah, 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 king of the south shall do the next thing, Daniel 11 is the focus, but Daniel 11 is only part of 10 to 12. Don't forget that. So I'm not going to go into detail about what appears to be the historical bits and pieces, but we need to read it just to get a flavour for what the chapter's on about. So let's just read verses 5 through 15, just to get a general picture. I'm not going to dig into the details because I don't know the history very well, but we can get certainly a feel for the king of the south, king of the north, just by reading these verses, starting in 5 through 15. Then the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes. He shall gain power over him and of dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. Verse 7, but from a branch of her roots one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army. Lots of battles here, folks. Enter the fortress of the king of the north and deal with him and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold. He shall continue more years than the king of the north. Then the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. However, his sons shall stir up strife, assemble a multitude of great forces, you know, armies, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then they shall return to his fortress and stir up strife, and the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude of army, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemies. So you get the impression, king of the south pushing at, battling with, jostling with the king of the south, fighting with the king of the north, and they sort of they push and shove and push and shove over, actually, centuries. Verse 12, when he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up. He will cast down tens of thousands, but will not prevail, for the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. These are wars being fought over centuries between the king of the north and the king of the south. Verse 14, and in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also certain violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city. And on it goes. So I don't want to look into the detail there. I only want to establish that as we're reading through chapter 11, we're reading about the history, at least, it appears to be history, of king of the north fighting and pushing against the king of the south. These guys are in competition for power and for rule. Now, historians who do know their history, unlike me, tell us that the details that we just raced through here are actually very, very accurate about what literally seems to have taken place. Now, they're so accurate that skeptics don't believe this is a prophecy. Hang on a second, this is too accurate, this is too good. We don't believe in inspired prophecies. What must have happened here is this guy, Daniel, is really a mythical character. It's some Jewish writer who came along after these things happened and wrote down pretending to prophesy them, but they already happened. So that just shows you how accurate they are. If you believe the Bible is inspired, of course, that's not a problem. You know, God knows, and he gave the inspiration, and it's prophecy, and it came to pass. Now, historically, the King of the North and the King of the South rose up from the breakup of the empire of Alexander the Great. You know, Alexander the Great was a very powerful, successful military leader who pretty much ran the world from Greece and Macedonia right across to India. He was a top man, you know, great, successful military leader, but he died in his 30s, his early 30s. His empire, of course, people start thinking, I'll have some of that. So his generals started to carve up the empire, and out of the dozen or 20 different bits and pieces who sort of fought and killed each other, eventually it settled down into some four bigger parts, but actually only two of them ever became really relevant. One is the King of the North, and that was the empire that was ruled by the Emperor Seleucus. And that's S-E-L-E-U-C-U-S. Of course, he didn't live forever, so he had sons and sons and sons' sons, so it became a dynasty. So the Seleucid dynasty, which ran for a number of centuries, is the King of the North, because it's the northern part of all those empires. And it was made up of countries today we refer to as Syria, Iraq, Iran, right across to Pakistan, and the other side, Turkey. So the King of the North, the Seleucid dynasty, for many centuries ruled this all, this northern stretch of the Middle East, from Turkey in the west right across to Pakistan, possibly even into Afghanistan. Massive empire. The King of the South, and nobody disputes this, by the way, King of the South at that time was Ptolemy, another of Alexander's generals. Ptolemy starts with a P. P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, Ptolemy. And, of course, his sons and grandsons and all the rest of them, the Ptolemaic dynasty. And that was made up of the territories of Egypt in the main, plus Libya, plus the Sudan, and they all border each other. So the King of the North, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, King of the South, Egypt, Libya, Sudan, they're all still around today. And of course, you'll have recognized those are all Islamic countries, right? And that's what they are. All of those countries are Islamic nations. And if you look at a map, and I would recommend you might want to go into Google, put some things in there about, you know, Greek Empire, Ottoman Empire, Roman Empire, if you want. Have a look at the territories they cover. Look at a map, you'll find that Syria, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Pakistan are all in the northern area geographically of this part of the world. It makes sense to call them the King of the North. And equally, you look at the map, you'll find that down below them, you've got the King of the South, which is Egypt, Libya, and Sudan. Geographically, one's in the north, one's in the south. Makes perfect sense. And if you wanted to be a bit more precise and say, you know what, I wonder if God's given these directions from the point of view of Jerusalem. After all, Jerusalem is ground zero. It's where Jesus Christ will rule in the world tomorrow. It's where everything revolves around Jerusalem. If you take Jerusalem, what's north of Jerusalem? Well, actually, Syria, Iraq, Turkey, Iran, and so on. And south of them, yep, you've guessed it, Libya, Egypt, and Sudan. So either way you look at it, it's just fairly sort of common, fairly sensible. And actually identifying the King of the South, King of the North, that's it. It's no more complicated than that, right? What they were before is what they are today. It's what they will be in the very end time, in my view. However, our traditional view, which, to be fair, is actually quite common, not just in the churches of God, but out there in Bible prophecy land more generally, because everybody thinks Rome is the key player, which they aren't, but because people have that sort of view in their heads, somehow the King of the North becomes the Holy Roman Empire. It's hard to see that. And the King of the South, well, you still tend to get people saying, well, that's probably Egypt, or maybe it's Ethiopia. But then Mr. Flory comes along and he identifies the King of the South as Iran, which can't possibly work because Iran is east of Jerusalem and its capital, Tehran, is north of Jerusalem. Hardly with a King of the South, can it? And historically, incidentally, Iran was part of the empire of Seleucus, the King of the North. So Iran's actually part of the King of the North, historically, in reality, properly, in the real world, not in Mr. Flurry's made-up world. So my view is you simply carry forward the historic geographies of the Kings of the North and South into the future. That's consistent, isn't it? What they were, what they are today, is what they are tomorrow. I think that's being responsible. The King of the South used to be Egypt, and nobody really disputes that. But Mr. Flory changes it to Iran, even though the capital of Iran is 1,000 miles away from Cairo, and it's northeast. So that's irresponsible to move the King of the South from Egypt, move him 1,000 miles northeast, and say that's where he is today. How did you get that? And equally, I think, saying Rome's King of the North is just as bad. So, anyway, let's go back to Daniel 11. Because I said the future begins at verse 21, so let's pick up there. It may pick up earlier. I'm leaving that open. But certainly, I'm pretty sure it picks up at 21, and you see sort of why in a while. And in his place shall arise, this is talking to the King of the North, sorry, the King of the North starts just here. In his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honour of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably, but seize the kingdom by intrigue, devious individual. He mentioned here is a vile person. This is the end time, I'm going to suggest anyway. This is the end time Islamic Antichrist, who comes to power at the very end, and there's a description of what he's like here. He's vile. Other translations use terms contemptible or despicable. And it says that he comes in peaceably. That always helps, doesn't it, to get received by people. You come in as a peacemaker, and he seizes the power, the kingdom, by intrigue. He is devious, underhanded. He's going to get away with things. Watch out for a devious, vile person. He's coming. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, oh, what a surprise, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, riches, and he shall devise his plans against his strongholds, but only for a time. So here's a guy who is a deceiver. He will appear peaceful. He will fool people. He'll fool presidents and prime ministers. He'll fool the United Nations. Look at verses 25 through 27. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the King of the South with a great army. Oh, what a surprise. Nothing's changed. What they were doing centuries ago, they're still doing at the end time. And the King of the South shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. So this northern king, this King of the North, which would be the territories of Turkey through Syria, Iraq, Iran, and so on, and the countries of Egypt and Libya and Sudan are having a bit of a loggerheads. Verse 26, yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. A lot of bloodshed, a lot of killing. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. The King of the North, you've probably got the leader of the geographical nations of the North. That will be the end time Antichrist person. And down in the King of the South is probably going to be an actual physical leader of these nations and their armies. And when they sit down to have a discussion about peace. They're both liars. Devious, underhanded, probably satanically inspired liars. Right? That's what's coming. It's ahead of us. And we shouldn't be surprised, would we, that Islamic nations fight each other. It's sort of been happening for a very long time. Just think of Syria today. How many different Islamic nations are in there busy killing each other? It's just, standard operating procedure for Islam. Just like it said earlier in Daniel 2, it talks of iron and miry clay don't mix. Yeah, you bet they don't. And you've also got, of course, Shia and Sunni Islam that don't mix either. Now let's drop down to verse 30. For ships from Cyprus, or the margin says Kittim, K-I-T-T-I-M, I think the King James says Kittim, for ships from Kittim shall come against him, the King of the North. So King North is doing something, he's busy on the march, along comes ships from Kittim against the King of the North. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So what you got here, without getting into too much detail, is the King of the North is on his journeys, busy attacking and plundering, but he's stopped in his tracks, at least temporarily, by ships from Kittim, who come against the King of the North. So quite clearly Kittim isn't the King of the North, because it comes against the King of the North and temporarily thwarts him. Who's this? Who are these armies who come against the King of the North? Ships from Kittim, naval forces from Kittim. Who's this? Well, if you look at the meaning of the word Kittim, K-I-T-T-I-M, or Cyprus it says here, it generally refers to the coastlands of the Mediterranean, or the western parts of the Mediterranean. For example, three other translations you could look at. One says ships of the western coastlands. So if we said the King of the North is somewhere like, say Turkey, Syria, that sort of direction, ships from the western coastlands come against him. The CEV translation says ships from the west. And the Good News Bible sticks his neck right out. It says the Romans will come in ships and oppose him. So, Western Europe or Rome come, what are they doing? They're coming against the King of the North. Is that not a bit of a clue that the King of the North isn't Rome? The King of the North isn't Western Europe? Because here comes Western Europe and Rome against the King of the North. All right? Now, it doesn't last, as we see a bit later, the King of the North's back on his warpath in no time at all. But I think that, in a sense, that helps us to just recognize that this idea the King of the North is German-led Western Europe doesn't fly, doesn't work. Okay, Daniel 11 and verse 31. And forces shall be mustered by him, the King of the North, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. They shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Excuse me. So that's quite important. All right? The King of the North takes away the daily, the word sacrifices is in italics, but daily sacrifices is what it meant. And he puts there in the sanctuary the abomination of desolation. Does two things. Takes away the sacrifices, number one. Number two, sets up the abomination of desolation. Now, most commentaries you'll turn to say, this was a guy called Antiochus Epiphanes way back in 168 BC. He desecrated the temple of God at that time. He sacrificed a swine on the altar and even apparently set up a statue of the pagan god Zeus in God's temple. This, of course, is folk who see all of these verses as being history. I'm saying their future, not history. Now, it's certainly quite possible that Antiochus, who did these things, left a sort of shadowy outline, foreshadow. But I think, as we will see, hopefully, don't run out of time, this is future. That comes through from chapter 12, but we'll get there in a bit. So as far as I'm concerned, this is an end time action. There's taking away sacrifices and erecting an abomination. End time action by the final king of the north, the vile and despicable deceiver. Now, while we're at this verse, just notice sort of these words. The word daily sacrifices is Hebrew tamid. That's T-A-M-I-Y-D. Well, in English letters, that's what it is. Tamid, T-A-M-I-Y-D. Abomination is a Hebrew word shikuts, S-H-I-Q-Q-U-T-S, shikuts. And desolation is a shomem, S-H-A-M-E-M. Tamid, shikuts, shomem. That's take away the sacrifices, erect the abomination of desolation. We'll see later where that otherwise appears, and if we're going to be consistent and interpret it just as it appears, it's important to remember those words. Okay, Daniel 11, 32 to 35. And this is where people who say everything's historic suddenly sort of say, well, yeah, but somewhere about here, it starts to sort of a subtly shift from the past to the future. Some say it's verse 35. Some say it's halfway through verse 32. I have to admit, my inspired marginal notes from a long time ago suggest halfway through verse 32 is when it swaps from the past to the future. Well, I think I was wrong. I think this is all future. So, verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he, the king of the north, shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. To me, this is all yet future. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. So we have seen references to the saints being harassed and worn down, have we not? And beheaded, right? And it says here, at this time, which I'm going to tell you, you know, for sure, is the very end time, the saints, once again, fall by the sword. Is that beheading? Or just, you know, weaponry generally, flames, are, you know, burned at the stake, captivity, plundering. Now, when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue, false brethren, and some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purge them, and make them white until the time of the end. Because it's still for the appointed time. It does give it away, doesn't it? This is future. It's the time of the end. Notice verse 35, it talks about these saints, these people of God, fall, are refined, are purged, and made white. Because that description pops up again in a moment, and it helps to identify the specific time that these things are happening. So before we read the rest of Daniel 11, let's just try and establish that we are talking in this whole passage here about, you know, the very end. And Daniel 12 pretty much gives the game away. So let's turn to Daniel 12 and read verse 1. Now remember, Daniel 12 verse 1 isn't Daniel 12 verse 1. That's only helping us to find it. It's actually the continuation of what was in Daniel 11, right? So don't get foxed by that. Nothing is changed. We haven't got different angels. We haven't got a big gap of 2 or 3 years. This is the conversation is unbroken. Same angel, he's still talking to Daniel. At that time, he says to Daniel, what time, by the way? Well, time we've just been reading about, right? Just spent all that time and he's still talking. Right? He hasn't gone off for his, you know, evening meal and come back a bit later. It's still exactly what he was just referring to. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. Now, when is that? Pretty obvious. It's a great tribulation, right? Because Jesus said in Matthew 24, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, and we just read that moment ago, he says, get out of Judea, because then will be a time of great tribulation, such as has never been on the earth until that time, no, nor ever shall be. So Jesus is referring to what we just read in Daniel 11. Jesus says it's a time of great trouble. The angel says here, this time is a time of great trouble, unlike any other time. We know what that is, don't we? This is the end time. There's no question. This is the end time. Carrying on in verse 1. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Well, that looks to me like the resurrection. Did that happen in 70 AD? Did it happen 100 years after Daniel's around? No. The end time is when the resurrection happens, when there's the greatest tribulation of all time ever. There can't be any doubt. This is the end of the end time. This is right up to and bumping into the resurrection of the saints. It's hopefully that's clear. Verse 4, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. The time of the end is when there's great trouble like none ever before, and when the saints are resurrected. That's the end time, right? That's what it says. Not really interpreting much here, I'm just reading what's there. And of course, by the way, since it's shut up and sealed, the prophecies until this end time, that means that poor old Mr. Hippolytus, or Hippolytus, whatever his name was, way back in 200 AD, that says, the fourth empire of Daniel 2 is Rome. Sorry, mate. You're 1800 years premature. You can't understand the book of Daniel. It's sealed. And Jerome, who came along about 400 AD and said, yep, for sure, Daniel 2:40 is definitely Rome. Sorry, mate. Isaac Newton, brilliant man, inventor, astronomer, poet, Bible scholar, wrote commentaries on the book of Daniel. Sir Isaac Newton, great man. Sorry, mate. Not your fault, but you weren't around at the time of the end, so you can't understand it. It was sealed. But you and I can, because I think we are at the time of the end. And perhaps it's only when the Islamic forces have matured to where they are today that you can start to really pick out what this is referring to. Okay, now at this point we've got two angels who decide to have a bit of a conversation, which has been recorded for us. So let's read the conversation and see what it tells us about the end time. And what these two angels are going to do as they converse is, we're going to see, they're actually talking to each other and they quote parts of Daniel 11, applying them to the very, very, very end time. In other words, when I said Daniel 11:31 isn't history, it's future, that's what these angels tell us. They quote those verses. This is still a continuation, remember? It's not these angels came along 2 years later. Daniel 12 and 11 and 10 are all one long, continuous vision. So these angels have a chat and they say, let's see, verses 5 to 7. Then I, Daniel, looked and there stood two others, one on this riverbank, the other on that riverbank. One said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? How long is it going to take? When's it all going to happen? Then I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time, and when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished or complete. So he says it's going to be a time of harassment, persecution, and destruction of the power of the holy people, which will last for time, times half a time, or 3.5 years. We've seen that many times. That's quite consistent. And when that 3.5 years is up, it's all finished. So this is right up to the final 3.5 years at the end. Verse 10. Many shall be purified, made white, and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Notice, many shall be purified, made white, and refined. What's the angel doing? He's quoting from verses 32 to 35. Because there, we just read that the saints shall fall to refine them, to purge them, to make them white until the time of the end. So the angel here is actually quoting from, which verse was it exactly? Verse 35. And here in Daniel 12, they're talking about literally the end, the completion, the grand finale. And they apply Daniel 11:35 precisely to that time. Then one of the angels picks up the conversation with Daniel. Let's read this in verses 8, 9, and 11. Verse 8, Daniel says, "Although I heard, I did not understand. I said, 'My Lord, what shall be the end? What's the outcome of these things?' And he said, 'Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end.'" Verse 11, "And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. What's the angel doing? He's quoting Daniel 11, verse 31, where we read, "They shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation." So the angel's talking here about literally the end time, and he quotes from what we call the previous chapter. Obviously, it wasn't. He's referring back to the early part of the conversation. The same words, by the way. Daily is Tomid. Abomination is Shekuts. Desolation is Shomem. It's the same. So when people claim that Daniel 11:31 is Antiochus Epiphanes in the far distant past, not going with that. The angel quotes those verses and applies them to the very, very, very end time. The last 1,290 days. That's obviously 30 days longer than time times and half a time. That's right at the end. Right? I think it's abundantly plain. So I'm going to go back and say for sure, Daniel 11:21, it's the future run-in of the King of the North, including his taking away the sacrifices, putting up the abomination of desolation, coming in looking peaceful, but being a backstabbing deceiver who triggers the Great Tribulation for the final 3.5 years. And we see that also, by the way. Let's turn to Daniel 9, 26 to 27. We've been here before, so this is hopefully not unfamiliar ground. But I think it all fits. I think it all sort of joins together, you know, as reasonably as prophecy ever does. Daniel 9 and verse 26. And of course, the angel's giving prophecy here to Daniel about what will happen to Daniel's people and the people in the end times. After the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Now, of course, the people of the prince who is to come, we spent a little bit of time saying those people were actually from Syria, from Egypt, and they were in the legions that actually physically destroyed the temple and the sanctuary. It may have been under Emperor or the Roman general Titus, but the destroying people were actually locals. Verse 27, "Then he," this vile prince, this despicable prince, "then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, which we take to be 7 years," as brought out earlier in this passage. "He shall confirm a covenant with many for, let's say, 7 years, but in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which it determined is poured out on the desolator," I should say. So here is, the language is a bit confusing, I get that. But what you can see here is there's a covenant, a treaty set up for 7 years. I'm going to suggest it's a peace treaty. I think that's what would lull the Jewish people into entering a peace treaty to protect their city and their state. But halfway through it, in the middle of that 7 years, you know, the true prince becomes apparent, and he turns. He takes away the sacrifices. That's in verse 27. And he sets up, it says, on the wing of abominations, and Mabioni makes desolate. The word abominations there is shekuts, makes desolate is shamem. And then, of course, that triggers the final half of the week, the final 3.5 years, which is the Great Tribulation. And 3.5 years, or 1290 days, or time, times and half a times, we've seen that all over Daniel. Daniel 7, Daniel 12, Jesus' words. So, the abomination of desolation, I think there's only the one. It didn't happen in Antiochus' day. That's all yet to come, according to the angels in Daniel 12. Right, with that, let's go back to Daniel 11, pick up the bits we missed out so far, starting in verse 36. So that was sort of a long-winded way of saying that, you know, this is future. Daniel 11:31 is not Antiochus. It's going to happen yet in the future. Like Jesus said, that's what he said. Jesus said, you know, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel in the holy place, then do these things. People say, well, yeah, that was 70 AD. No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't, because the angel said in Daniel 12, it's the time of the resurrection. So forget all that nonsense about times past, it's future. So with all of that, we pick up in verse 36. Then the king of the north, this is still, shall do according to his own will. This is the, I think, Islamic leader. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above them all. Of course, the God of his fathers, if you think about it, you know, Muhammad, many Arabs say they're descended from Abraham, right? Through Ishmael, etc. So that's what they claim. And of course, the God of Abraham would be a Jehovah God. And it says, you know, they don't regard the God of Abraham. They don't regard Jehovah God. They regard some character called Allah. And Allah is none other than Satan, in my humble opinion. Verse 38, but in their place he shall honour a god of fortresses, a god which his fathers did not know. He shall honour with gold and silver, precious stones and pleasant things. Could be Allah again. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. He shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. So, this is a individual who seems to relish war, fighting, and honours the god of war. We might say honours the god of jihad. Now, who might that be, I wonder? Okay, let's read verses 40 to 45, and then we're sort of pretty much getting towards the end. Daniel 11, 40 to 45. At the time of the end, well, we know what that is, don't we? We've seen it already. The king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him. So where we started in Daniel 11, king of the north fighting the king of the south pushing the king of the north comes back against king of the south, north, south, north, south. That's been happening, it looks like, forever. And it's got another phase yet to come. So at the time of the end, the king of the south, which I'm going to say is Egypt, in alliance with Libya and Sudan, because it always has been that way, shall attack or push at the king of the north. King of the north, I'm going to say, is Turkey and Syria and Iraq and Iran and Pakistan in general, but probably some individual who comes from those regions and becomes the dominant leader, right? And the king of the north shall come against the king of the south like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, many ships, shall enter the countries, overwhelm them and pass through. So he's the one who's going to get the victory, right? King of the north is actually more powerful anyway. If you look at Turkey and Iran and Iraq, maybe not so much Syria at the moment, think perhaps of Pakistan, some of the Islamic states of southern Turkey. There's a lot of power there, a lot of military there, a lot of manpower there. You know, Egypt, Libya, Sudan, yeah, got some. But it wouldn't surprise me that, you know, it's easier for the King of the North to, you know, wipe the floor with the King of the South. Verse 41, he shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Verse 42, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and today probably oil, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. So these are three Islamic nations, one should point out, that the King of the North has come to heel. Heel boys, and they have to get behind, right? Now it says Egypt, Libya, and my Bible says Ethiopia. You know, Ethiopia in the scriptures, in the Hebrew, is actually Cush. And several Bible translations, the ESV, and the ISV, the NIV, and others say Cushites. They sort of won't be committed. They say Cushites. But today, it's more likely that what you and I call Sudan. And in fact, the God's Word translation says he will control gold and silver treasures and all Egypt's treasuries. Libya and Sudan will surrender to him. And Sudan is a, I don't know a great deal about it. Had a quick check of Wiki earlier today. It says Sudan used to be home of the kingdom of Kush. Oh, what a surprise. So the Kushites, yeah, modern day Sudan. Sudan is an Islamic country. This absolutely fits in with everything we've seen so far. Its government, its legal system is based on Sharia law. That's the law of Muhammad. And apparently, interestingly, a stoning and crucifixion are both legal. By the government, I assume. Now, you remember back in Daniel chapter 7, the fourth beast had 10 horns. And after the 10 horns popped up a little horn, a pompous horn, that spoke, you know, blasphemies. And it says that little horn subdued 3 of the first 10 horns. It's probably this event we're looking at here. The little pompous horn is the Islamic Antichrist. He subdues 3 horns of the 10. And this is them here, I think. Egypt, Libya, and Sudan. Now, traditionally, of course, our view of the King of the South pushing at the King of the North is that, somehow Egypt or maybe some other countries over there are going to push economically at Europe, maybe, you know, threaten oil supplies or something like that. And because Western Europe is very dependent on its oil supplies for its heating and its power and its lighting and its cars, if there's economic pressure put on from some of these countries over there somewhere in the King of the South of the region, give or take a bit, then that's it. A German-led Europe will not take it any longer, and they're going to react and invade the Middle East. That's our traditional view. You know, something along that lines anyway. Well, I'm going to suggest, no, it's not. What we've got here is simply the Islamic nations doing what they've always done, competing for power and rule and money. It could be centered around the sort of the Sunni, Shia, Islamic divisions. Don't know. Might be part of it. It's almost certainly the case that somewhere among it all, they're focusing over fighting for power over Jerusalem. Because after Mecca and Medina, Jerusalem has the third holiest site in all Islam, which is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So to 1.7 billion Muslims and to the Muslim Islamic nations of Turkey and Syria and Iran and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Egypt, Jerusalem is where the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site, is based. And there's no surprise if they go to war to fight over who's going to own it. Okay, so once the King of the North Verse 43, he shall have power, the king of the north, over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Sudan shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and from the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace, his royal pavilion, between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. I guess we've got no more time to go into any more detail sort of there, but once this king of the north has conquered these three nations, I think that may be the time he decides to appoint himself as the caliph, whom all Muslims must obey, all 1.7 billion, because the caliph, if he's recognized and accepted, has complete spiritual authority and complete secular civil authority over every Muslim and over all their countries. So this guy becomes, at this point perhaps, the undisputed ruler over vast territories, vast wealth, and 1.7 billion followers. So I guess you could say that there are interesting times ahead of us, as this age comes to a very violent end. I know we shouldn't become, you know, prophecy hobbyists, but, you know, we said before, we should be familiar with what the scriptures say in them, what the narratives are. We should be, you know, looking out for the signs of the times. Jesus criticized the Pharisees for not doing that. And you and I should be people who are, you know, watchful and alert. And of course, as these things do come to pass, and they will come to pass, we shouldn't be, in a sense, be downhearted at wars and rumors of wars and violence and all the rest of it, because these things are just the death throes of this age of Satan. As these things come to pass, the reality is that it means that the Lord Jesus is at the door. And after it's all over, Jesus is here. The world tomorrow has begun, and peace and prosperity reign for all mankind. So, okay, as these things happen, yeah, fair enough. For a brief time, it might be a little bit sort of, nerve-wracking, a little bit sort of, oops, was that going to take us all? But ultimately, we look beyond that and just think, this is the end of one age, and all these events, right, they're pointing to the return of Jesus Christ, our Savior, and the Prince of Peace. So that would be something really, really to look forward to. Okay, with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.